you choose to tell. The people we seek to serve have a noise in their heads that's different than your noise. Chapter 12. A Better Business Plan. Where are you going? What's holding you back? It's not clear to me why business plans are the way they are, but they're often misused to obfuscate, bore, and show an ability to comply with expectations. If I want to see the truth about a business and where it's going, I'd rather see a more useful document. I'd divide the modern business plan into 5 sections. Truth, assertions, alternatives, people, money. The truth section describes the world as it is. Footnote if you want to, but tell me about the market you are entering, the needs that exist, the competitors in your space, technology standards, and how others have succeeded and failed in the past. The more specific, the better. The more ground knowledge, the better. The more visceral the stories, the better. The point of this section is to be sure that you're clear about how you see the world and that you and I agree on your assumptions. This section isn't partisan. It takes no positions. It just states how things are. Truth can take as long as you need to tell it. It can include spreadsheets, market share analysis, and anything else I need to know about how the world works. The assertion section is your chance to describe how you're going to change things. We will do X, and then Y will happen. We will build Z with this much money in this much time. We will present Q to the market, and the market will respond by taking this action. You're creating tension by telling stories. You're serving a specific market. You're expecting something to happen because of your arrival. What? This is the heart of the modern business plan. The only reason to launch a project is to make change, to make things better. And we want to know what you're going to do and what impact it's going to have. Of course, this section will be inaccurate. You will make assertions that won't pan out. You'll miss budgets and deadlines and sales. So, the alternative section tells me what you'll do if that happens. How much flexibility does your product or team have? If your assertions don't pan out, is it over? The people section rightly highlights the key element. Who is on your team and who is going to join your team? Who doesn't mean their resumes. It means their attitudes and abilities and track record in shipping. You can go further here. Who are the people you're serving? Who are the champions? What do they believe about status? What worldview do they have? The last section is all about money. How much do you need? How will you spend it? What cash flow looks like? Profit and loss, balance sheets, margins, and exit strategies. Your local VC might not like this format, but I'm betting it will help your team think through the hard issues more clearly. Perhaps you've seen the shift. When you began listening to this program, you probably said, I have a product and I need more people to buy it. I have a marketing problem. By now, I hope that you see the industrialist, selfish nature of this statement. The purpose of our culture isn't to enable capitalism, even capitalism that pays your bills. The purpose of capitalism is to build our culture. Once you adopt a posture of service, of engaging with the culture to make change, the shift happens. Now, instead of asking, how can I get more people to listen to me? How can I get the word out? How can I find more followers? How can I convert more leads to sales? How can I find more clients? How can I pay my staff? You can ask, what change do I seek to make? Once you know what you stand for, the rest gets a lot easier. A glib reverse engineering of your mission statement isn't helpful. Too often, we get hung up on our purpose, our why, our reason for being. And too often, that purpose is simply a backward way of saying, I'd like to sell more of what I've already decided to sell. In my experience, most marketers actually have the same purpose: to be successful, to engage with people in a way that benefits both sides, to be respected, seen, and appreciated, to make enough of a profit to do it again. That's your why. That's why you go to work. Okay, got it. But a better business plan takes that universal need and makes it specific, describing who and what it's for. It outlines the tension you seek to create, the status roles you're engaging with, and the story you're bringing that will make change happen. That's not your purpose. It's not your mission. It's simply what you do. If it doesn't work, that's okay. It doesn't mean you're without a purpose or that your why is doomed. All it means is that you've ruled out one more route in your quest to matter. Now, you can find a new one. Chapter 13. Semiotics, Symbols, and Vernacular. Can you hear me now? We communicate with symbols. The letters C-A-R aren't an icon of a car or a picture of a car. They're a stand-in, a symbol that, if you know English, brings to mind a car. Nike spent billions of dollars to teach millions of people that the swoosh is a symbol of human possibility and achievement, as well as status and performance. And if you're a designer, the typeface Comic Sans is a symbol of bad taste, low status, and laziness. Marketers have the humility to understand that not everyone sees a symbol the same way, the awareness to use the right symbol for the right audience, and the guts to invent new symbols to be placed on top of old ones. 100 years ago, semiotics was in its infancy. It wasn't something done by a billion people a day, every day, as we market to each other online. Now, our ability to do this with intent, or with naive intuition, can make the difference between success and failure. What does this remind you of? Busy people, you know, the kind of people you seek to change, don't care about your work as much as you do. They're not as up-to-date as you are, or as aware of the competitive landscape, or the drama behind the scenes. We scan instead of study. And when we scan, we're asking, what does this remind me of? This means that the logo you use, the stories you tell, and the appearance of your work all matter. Your words resonate with us, not only because of what they mean, but because of how they sound and how you use them. It's not just the stuff. It's even the way you set up the room for your company offsite. If it reminds us of a high school cafeteria, we know how to act. If it's a bunch of round tables set for a chicken dinner, we know how to act. And if there are row upon row of hotel-type chairs in straight lines, we know how to sit and act glazed. We don't care about you or how hard you worked on it. We want to know if it's for us and if you're the real deal. This is semiotics. Flags and symbols, shortcuts and shorthand. Do the flashing lights at an arena rock concert change the way the music sounds? Perhaps they do, because they remind us we're at an arena rock concert. When we hold a newspaper, it feels different than a tablet or a comic book or a Bible. The form changes the way the words sound. A chocolate bar presents itself differently than a chemotherapy drug. When we walk into a medical office that feels like a surgeon's office, we remember how that surgeon helped us, even if this office belongs to a chiropractor. When we pick up a book that feels self-published, we treat it differently than the book that reminds us of a classic we read in high school. When we get a phone call and hear the telltale clicks and pauses before the stranger begins to speak, we remember all the robocalls and phone spam we've gotten and hang up before the caller even utters a word. and when the website is designed with GeoCities and flashing GIFs. If you remind me of a scam, it will take a long time to undo that initial impression. That's precisely why so many logos of big companies look the same. It's not laziness. The designers are trying to remind you of a solid company. That's the work of reminds me of. You can do it with intent. Hiring a professional. The internet is littered with websites, emails, and videos made by amateurs. Amateurs who made something that they liked, which is fine. But what a professional does for you is design something that other people will like. They create a look and feel that reminds people of their sort of magic. There's not one professional look, not one right answer. A summer blockbuster gives itself away in four frames of film. It's clearly not a YouTube video from a teen makeup guru. Every once in a while, the amateur happens to find a vernacular that reminds the right people of the right story. The rest of the time, it's best to do it with intent. Imagine that world. Don LaFontaine made more than 5,000 movie and TV voiceovers. It's not because he was more talented at speaking than anyone else, or because he was the cheapest. It's because his head start compounded. And if a studio chief wanted to remind the audience of a big-time movie, his voice could do that, precisely because he was reminding you of his earlier work. It's important to remember that it doesn't matter what you, the marketer who created it, is reminded of. Semiotics doesn't care who made the symbol. The symbol is in the mind of the person looking at it. And it's even more important to remember that there's no one right answer. The symbol that works for one group won't work for another. In Silicon Valley, the hoodie is a symbol of status. I'm too busy to go clothes shopping. In a different context, though, for a different audience, a hoodie in East London might put someone on alert instead of reassuring them. Why is Nigerian spam so sloppy? If you've gotten an email from a prince offering to split millions of dollars with you, you may have noticed all the misspellings and other telltale clues that it can't possibly be real. Why would these sophisticated scammers make such an obvious mistake? Because it's not for you. Because they're sending a signal to people who are skeptical, careful, and well-informed. Go away. The purpose of the email is to send a signal to the greedy and the gullible. Because putting anyone else into the process just wastes the scammer's time. They'd rather lose you at the beginning than invest in you and lose you at the end. The flags on SUVs are called flares. In 2018, the more expensive a car is, the more likely it is to have slightly exaggerated flares around the wheels. These flares are easier to make than they used to be, robots bending steel, but they remain a signifier, a message about the status of the car and its driver. They have no real function. The flare is more than 6 inches away from the wheel, but they remain. And in the aftermarket, you can pay extra for an even bigger flare, sort of surgical augmentation for your car. Do that too much, and your status goes down with most bystanders, not up, just as it does with plastic surgery. The Cadillac XTS goes even further. There is a tiny flare on the back of each taillight. Again, no useful purpose, except to remind some people, just a bit, of the Batmobile, or the 1955 Lincoln Futura. These flags of status are everywhere we look. Alex Peck points out that driving gloves have a big hole in the back. Why? Perhaps it's left over from when men with cars wore big watches, and the glove needed a hole to give the watch a place to poke through. Over time, we forgot the big watch and just kept the hole. It's a symbol. These leftover utilities have become symbols, and once a symbol becomes well known, like the tiny details on an Hermès handbag, it's quickly copied, manipulated, and spread, until it ceases to be scarce, and then becomes merely a signal of changing taste. What's your flag? Why would someone fly it? The flag is not for everyone. It's worth restating that the smallest viable market gives you the freedom to pick those you seek to serve. And those people are seeking a certain symbol. It's likely, if you've chosen the market well, that the symbol they seek is quite different from one that would work for a larger audience. There's a paradox here. If we want to make change, we need to go first, hanging over one edge or another. But often, that innovation reminds some people of a past event that went wrong. We begin by serving an audience that's okay with that, because it's the only audience that will give us a chance with our new thing. Send a signal that feels like a sign we already trust, then change it enough to let us know that it's new and that it's yours. The same and the different. Most car ads look the same. That's because the sameness sends a signal about the car being worth considering, a safe alternative for such a huge investment. Fashion ads in Vogue look nothing like the ads in Field & Stream or Sports Illustrated. Why? The vernacular matters. You're not people like us if you don't talk. Talk means typefaces, photo styles, copy, the way we expect you to. This is what a good designer offers you, the chance to fit in. And sometimes you might choose to hire a great designer instead, someone who can break the expectation and talk differently, but not so differently that you don't resonate with those you seek to connect with. When ad legend Lee Clow took the imagery from George Orwell's 1984 to create the most iconic TV commercial of all time, almost no one watching Apple's Super Bowl ad understood all of the references. They'd read the book in high school, but if you want to impact 100 million beer-drinking sports fans, an assigned high school book is not a good place to start. But the media-savvy talking heads instantly understood, and they took the bait and talked about it. And the nerds did, and they eagerly lined up to go first. The lesson? Apple's ad team only needed 1 million people to care, and so they sent a signal to them and ignored everyone else. It took 30 years for the idea to spread from the million to everyone, 30 years to build hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap. But it happened because of the brilliant use of semiotics, not technology. At every turn, Apple sent signals, and they sent them in just edgy enough words, fonts, and design that the right people heard the message. Case study. Where's Keith? Not all semiotics are benign. When Penelope Gazin and Kate Dwyer started their site witchsee.com, they had trouble getting their emails answered. They created a third partner, a fictional guy named Keith, gave him an email address, and had him initiate and participate in email threads. This simple shift exposed a shameful gap in how our society treats women and men. Emails from Keith were quickly responded to. Vendors, developers, and potential partners were more likely to get back to Keith, addressed him by name, and were more helpful, they reported to Fast Company. We're judging everything, and people are judging us in return. Often, those judgments are biased, incorrect, and inefficient. But denying them doesn't make them disappear. The marketer can use symbols to gain trust and enrollment, or find that those symbols work in the opposite direction. To change the culture, we have no choice but to acknowledge the culture we seek to change. That doesn't mean giving up, fitting in, or failing to challenge injustice. But it does require us to focus our stories and symbols with intent. Who's it for? What's it for? We add the flags with intent. The semiotic flags we choose to fly are up to us. Not flying one is as intentional as flying one. The people you are seeking to serve are trying to figure out who you are. If you're going to show up in their world, make it easy for them to know who you are and where you stand. The lazy thing to do is insist that you don't need a flag or a badge, that you don't have to nod your head to the cultural memes that came before, or even wear a uniform. The foolish thing to do is pretend your features are so good that nothing else matters. Something else always matters. Are brands for cattle? What's your brand? Hint, it's not your logo. In a super crowded world with too many choices, more than 20 kinds of toner to choose from for my laser printer, and more than 19,000 combinations of beverages at Starbucks, and with just about everything good enough, you're quite lucky if you have a brand at all. A brand is a shorthand for the customer's expectations. What promise do they think you're making? What do they expect when they buy from you, or meet with you, or hire you? That promise is your brand. Nike doesn't have a hotel. If it did, you would probably have some good guesses as to what it would be like. That's Nike's brand. If you have true fans, the only reason you do is because this group has engaged with you in a way that signals that they expect something worthwhile from you next time. That expectation isn't specific. It's emotional. A commodity, on the other hand, has no brand. If I'm buying wheat by the ton, or coffee by the pound, or bandwidth by the gigabyte, I don't have any expectations other than the spec. Get me exactly what I got yesterday, faster and cheaper, and I'll pay you for it. How do we know that brands like Verizon and AT&T are essentially worthless? Because if we switched someone from one to the other, they wouldn't care. If you want to build a marketing asset, you need to invest in connection and other non-transferable properties. If people care, you've got a brand. Does your logo matter? It matters less than your designer wants it to, but more than the typical committee realizes. If a brand is our mental shorthand for the promise that you make, then a logo is the post-it reminder of that promise. Without a brand, a logo is meaningless. Here's a simple exercise. Make a list of 5 logos you admire. As a consumer of design, draw or cut and clip 5 well-done logos. Got them? Okay, here's my prediction. Each one represents a brand you admire. Almost no one picks a swastika or the clever glyph of the bank who ripped them off. That's because logos are so wrapped up in the brand promise that we imbue them with all the powers of the brand, ignoring the pixels involved. Yes, it's possible for a terrible logo to adorn a fabulous brand. Complicated mermaid, anyone? Many of the best brands have no identifiable or memorable logo. Google, Sephora, and Costco come to mind. And of course, a quick glance at your Helvetica clip sheet shows that most brands couldn't be bothered. No, you shouldn't phone it in or be careless. No, you shouldn't choose a logo that offends or distracts people. Yes, you should pick a logo that works in different sizes in different media. But mostly, pick a logo. Don't spend a ton of money or have a lot of meetings about it. And keep it for as long as you keep your first name. Chapter 14. Treat different people differently. In search of the neophiliacs. In any group of 100 people, pick a measure. Height, weight, IQ score, hair length, speed on the 50-yard dash, number of Facebook friends. And you'll discover a significant number clump around the average. About 68 of the 100 people will be close to the average. Another 27 will be significantly further away. And 4 will be extreme outliers. This happens often enough that we call it a standard deviation. It turns out that this is especially true for human behavior. Everett Rogers demonstrated that when it comes to style, technology, or innovations, most people like what they have. They want to do what others are doing, and they aren't actively seeking novelty. Some people, though, the 15 or 16 people on the left side of the curve, are neophiliacs. You can find the curve I'm talking about at ses.blog/charts. They're early adopters. They want the better, the clever, the innovative. They'll wait in line to go to opening night of a movie. They'll upgrade their operating system right away. And they'll read Vogue magazine for the ads. And an equal number of folks, those on the right side of the curve, will defend their status quo to the last day. They still read Reader's Digest and use a VCR. Good marketers have the humility to understand that you shouldn't waste a minute, not of your time or of their time, on anyone who isn't on the left part of the curve. If someone is satisfied with what they have, you're unlikely to have the time or the money to reach out to them directly and cause them to become dissatisfied, that is, interested enough and open enough to changing and becoming a customer. It's not for them, not right now. With persistence and smarts, you'll get to them, perhaps, one day, horizontally, person to person, through earned media, but not right now. It's the neophiliacs, the folks with a problem that you can solve right now. Novelty and tension and the endless search for better that you can begin with. Enrollment. There's no such thing as mandatory education. It's almost impossible to teach people against their will. The alternative is voluntary education, gaining enrollment. We ask people to eagerly lend us their attention. The promise is that it's worth their effort because in exchange, they're going to get the insight or forward motion that they want. Enrollment is what you need to earn permission to engage. Enrollment is hands raised, eyes on the board, notes being taken. Enrollment is the first step on a journey where you learn from the customer and she learns from you. Enrollment is mutual. It is consensual, and it often leads to change. Lazy marketers try to buy enrollment with flashy ads. The best marketers earn enrollment by seeking people who want the change being offered, and they do it by connecting people to others who want the change as well. And that change is precisely what marketers seek. What do people want? That's probably the wrong question. Different people want different things. Neophiliacs want to go first. They want hope and possibility and magic. They want the thrill of it working and the risk that it might not. They want the pleasure of showing their innovation to the rest of the crew. And they want the satisfaction of doing better work faster, as well as the anticipation of being rewarded for their innovation and productivity. On the other hand, the typical corporate cog wants to avoid getting in trouble with the boss. And if trouble does happen, he wants an airtight alibi and a great way to avoid responsibility. The social crusader wants a glimmer of hope and the chance to make things right. The person who measures dominance instead of affiliation wants to win. And if he can't win, he might be willing to settle for watching his opponent lose. The affiliation-seeking tribe member wants to fit in, to be in sync, to feel the pleasure of people like us do things like this, without the risk of being picked to be the leader. Some people want responsibility, while others seek to be recognized. Some of those you seek to serve want a bargain, while a few eagerly want to overpay to prove that they can. Almost no one wants to feel stupid. More and more people have been seduced by the promise of convenience so that they don't have to pay attention or exercise judgment. Others feel empty when they're unable to contribute effort. The lesson? Always be wondering. Always be testing. Always be willing to treat different people differently. If you don't, they'll find someone who will. The super user. Some customers are worth more than others. You've certainly heard the stories of restaurants that keep a picture of the local restaurant critic on the wall of the kitchen. The thinking is that if you can spot the critic early in the meal, you can raise the quality of the experience and get a better review. If you can pull it off, this might be worth the effort. The thing is, everyone is a restaurant critic now. Everyone can post on Yelp or share the experience with others. And so, the thinking goes, you need to treat everyone better because everyone has more power. The math here doesn't hold up. Treating everyone better is a bit like treating everyone worse. Given your resources, you can't treat everyone better than you already are. Instead, you can look at the new normal and realize that while everyone has a platform, not everyone is using it. While everyone could be a neophiliac, a sneezer, a power user, a significant contributor, not everyone is taking that opportunity. You can learn a lot about people by watching what they do. And when you find someone who is adopting your cause, adopt them back. When you find someone who is eager to talk about what you do, give him something to talk about. When you find someone who is itching to become a generous leader, give her the resources to lead. We have the technological levers to treat different people differently if we choose to, but we'll need to watch and listen to be able to figure out what to offer and who to offer it to. The truth about customer contribution. It costs money to market. It costs money to wear a suit to the meeting, to have a storefront, to develop new software, to keep your items in stock, to run ads, and to pay for publicity, and 100 other things. These are all fixed costs, all spread across your entire customer base. If you do the math, what you'll see will look like the graph at seths.blog/charts. The dotted line is the amount you've spent per person on marketing, and the bars are how much gross margin you've earned from each customer, which means that only 8 of the customers on this graph actually contributed a profit to your project. The theory behind this graph is true for book buyers, restaurant goers, political donors, philanthropists, stamp collectors, and just about any industry where some customers spend more than others. When you ask, who's it for? The answer needs to be the kind of customers who are going to show up for us in a way that lets us keep going. You'll serve many people. You'll profit from a few. The whales pay for the minnows. It can work out, but in order to do your best work, you'll need to seek out and delight the few and in return, you'll be rewarded with a cadre of loyal customers who will buy in for all of it. What's the purpose of this interaction? Consider the valuable customer who reaches out to customer service about a problem. How do we know if they're valuable? Well, the customer service folks have a record of who's writing or calling. So we begin there. A quick search shows that this person has been a customer for years, keeps a lot of money in your bank, tweets about you, never returns items, pays on time, buys your high-margin items, and so on. In fact, if you do the math, you'll see that she produces 8 times the revenue of the average customer. And unlike the anonymous masses that cost you money, she's one of the few who generate the income that actually turns a profit. None of this would be an innovation if we were talking about a freelancer with 6 clients. When the big client calls, the freelancer instantly knows what's up. But we're talking about your financial institution, the one where the least respected and lowest paid person is busy answering the phone when your customers call, or your retail store, where the same thing is true. In that moment, then, when the phone lights up, what's the interaction for? If the goal is to get it over with, get the person off the phone, deny responsibility, read the script, use words like as stated and our policy, then please, sure, yes, keep doing what you're doing and watch it all fall apart. On the other hand, the cost of being human in this situation is easily covered by the upside of delighting an extraordinary customer. Get in your car, drive across town, and show up. Talk about it face to face. Run down to FedEx and get that shipment in the last pickup of the day. Amazement and delight go a long way. Have the CEO pick up the phone and call that customer that you accidentally triple charged. It'll take a few minutes, and it will be worth it. I know you can't do it for every customer, but you can learn to see and act accordingly. Chapter 15. Reaching the right people. Goals, strategy, and tactics. A brief aside before we get into more tactics. Tactics are easy to understand because we can list them. You use a tactic or you don't. Strategy is more amorphous. It's the umbrella over your tactics, the work the tactics seek to support. And your goal is the thing you'll be betting will happen if your strategy works. If you tell your competition your tactics, they'll steal them and it will cost you. But if you tell them your strategy, it won't matter, because they don't have the guts or the persistence to turn your strategy into their strategy. Your goal is the change you seek to make in the world. It could be the self-focused goal of earning money, but it's more likely to be the change you seek to make in those you serve. The goal is your shining light, the unwavering destination of your work. Your strategy is the long-lasting way you're investing in reaching that goal. Your strategy sits above the tactics. A strategy might be to earn trust and attention. A strategy might be to be seen as the best and maybe only alternative. A strategy might be to have alliances and partnerships that enable you and your message to reach exactly the right people. The way you use stories, status, and connection to create tension and forward motion is a strategy. A strategy, if successful, gets you closer to your goal. You might need to change your strategy if it fails, but you don't want to do it often. And the tactics? The tactics are the dozens or hundreds of steps you'll take on behalf of your strategy. If a tactic fails, that's okay, because another one can take its place and support the strategy you have in mind. You can change tactics the moment you decide that they're not helping you achieve your strategy any longer. For generations, Coca-Cola had a simple goal: get more people to drink more Coke. Their strategy was to run an enormous number of ads to persuade the mass market that Coke was part of the culture that made them happy, and that everyone else was drinking it too. And the ads kept changing because the content of the ad was a tactic. Patagonia's goal is to get a tiny group of outdoor enthusiasts to care about the environment and to express that care by wearing Patagonia apparel. In their words, these are all silent sports. None require a motor. None deliver the cheers of a crowd. In each sport, reward comes in the form of hard-won grace and moments of connection between us and nature. Their strategy is to redefine the way some people think about environmental impact as well as clothing quality, to give that small group a label and a tool they can use to evangelize their vision to their friends, to create insiders and outsiders. And their tactics range from finding new ways to recycle clothes, to placing stores in brick buildings, to choices about materials, selection, and price. When a tactic fails, they don't abandon their strategy, the same one they've had for more than 30 years. Advertising is a special case, an optional engine for growth. Media companies, telecommunication firms, and delivery services all make money doing the same thing: selling the attention of those they ostensibly serve. You can buy an ad in a magazine, in an online network, or with a stamp. In all three cases, you'll be able to reach, interrupt, educate, engage with all the people the intermediary promised. Anyone with a stamp can send a letter. You don't have to earn this attention, since you can buy it. You're no longer the outsider. Now you're the customer. You have cash, and you can use it to buy attention whenever you want, in as much quantity as you can afford. Here's the good news. When you find an ad approach that works, you can scale it. You can scale it quickly and precisely. And you've probably guessed the bad news. It's not easy to find an ad approach that works. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try, but you need to be clear about what you're doing and why. An ad, unnoticed, doesn't exist. A noticed ad is noticed by some people, not everyone. And if it's noticed by the right people, it creates tension. The tension of not knowing and needing to know more. The tension of being left behind. The tension that things might get better or worse. Almost all TV advertising is simply semiotic noise, reassuring the viewer, as seen on TV, that this is a safe brand, a brand you and your peers know, a brand that can afford to be on this box. That's a tax that major companies in competitive markets have to pay. But it's not the sort of marketing that's realistic to consider for anyone else. More than ever, but less than ever. More organizations run ads today than at any other time in history. If you've ever hit the boost button on Facebook, you're paying to be part of the ad business. It's never been easier or cheaper to spend money to get the word out. You can pay LinkedIn for the privilege of sending an email to a big shot. You can start by running free online ads for your nonprofit, and you can easily promote your conference or your bake sale. There are three elements to the magic of online advertising. One, you can reach people more precisely online than in any other medium. Not just the demographics of what they look like, but the psychographics of what they believe and what they're looking for. Two, you can reach people instantly. You can decide to run an ad at 10 a.m. and have it reach people beginning at 10:01 a.m. Three, you can measure everything. Since advertising is faster, cheaper, and more measurable than ever before, why isn't this the focus of all of our marketing? Why isn't this the beginning and end of the discussion? Because online advertising is also the most ignored advertising ever created. It's not unusual to run an ad in front of 100,000 people and not get a single click. It's not unusual for an entire ad campaign to start, run, and finish without making any impact on the culture. Advertising is unearned media. It's bought and paid for, and the people you seek to reach know it. They're suspicious. They're inundated. They're exhausted. You didn't pay the recipient to run that ad, but you want the recipient to pay you with their attention. So you're ignored. It's not that advertising can't work. It's simply that it's not the right answer for everyone, at least in this moment. What does attention cost? What is it worth? Please don't get distracted by the possibility of free attention. A spotlight that magically and generously makes you famous through no effort on your part. Even free publicity costs you in terms of time and effort. But for now, let's look at ads where the equation of cost and attention is clear. An ad in a fancy magazine will cost you $80 CPM, which means you get in front of 1,000 readers, using the term loosely, for $80, or a bit under a dime per person. An ad on a second-rate website might cost you $80 to be in front of 1 million people. But of course, these people are scanning, clicking, ignoring, and will neither remember your ad nor take action. Anyone about to buy an ad needs to ask, what's it worth? People seeking to make change happen are often in a hurry, and advertising feels like a shortcut. But without persistence and focus, the investment is wasted. Brand marketing makes magic. Direct marketing makes the phone ring. Lester Wunderman was the father of direct marketing. He named it and used it to build American Express, the Columbia Record Club, and 100 other projects. In 1995, I asked Lester to be on the board of Yoyodyne, the online direct marketing company I founded before the World Wide Web was a thing. Lester was first in describing the differences between brand and direct marketing, but his ideas have never been more relevant. Thanks to the rise of Google and Facebook, there's now more direct marketing than ever before in history. The difference is about what happens after the ad runs. Direct marketing is action-oriented, and it is measured. Brand marketing is culturally oriented, and it can't be measured. If you run an ad on Facebook and count your clicks, and then measure how many of them convert, you're doing direct marketing. If you put a billboard by the side of the highway, hoping that people will remember your funeral parlor the next time someone dies, you're doing brand marketing. It's entirely possible that your direct marketing will change the culture. That's a nice side effect. It may very well be that the ads you run, the catalogs you send out, and the visits to your site add up to a shift in the story that people tell themselves. And it's entirely possible that your brand marketing will lead to some orders. That's another nice side effect. It may very well be that your billboard leads to someone getting off at the next exit and handing you money, or that your sponsorship of a podcast leads to someone hiring your company. The danger is in being confused. The extraordinary growth of Google's and Facebook's revenue is due to only one thing. Many of the ads that are run on these services pay for themselves. $100 worth of online advertising generates $125 in profit for the advertiser. And she knows this, so she buys more. In fact, she keeps buying ads until they stop paying for themselves. On the other hand, brand advertising for products like Ford, Absolut Vodka, and Palmolive shaped our culture for generations. But these brands and countless others can't possibly build direct marketing campaigns that work. And so the shift to a measured direct marketing environment online has been stressful and riddled with failure. The approach here is as simple as it is difficult. If you're buying direct marketing ads, measure everything. Compute how much it costs you to earn attention, to get a click, to turn that attention into an order. Direct marketing is action marketing, and if you're not able to measure it, it doesn't count. If you're buying brand marketing ads, be patient. Refuse to measure. Engage with the culture. Focus by all means, but mostly be consistent and patient. If you can't afford to be consistent and patient, don't pay for brand marketing ads. The two paragraphs you just heard ought to have paid for the time and money you've spent listening to this program. I'm hoping that's not the only thing that repays your investment, but even the biggest and most successful organizations are failing to see how the shift to online interaction is fundamentally changing their business. Procter & Gamble spends billions on brand advertising on TV for Tide and Crest and other brands. When TV brand ads are replaced with digital direct ads, their business model falls apart. The local pizza place was hooked on Yellow Pages advertising. A big ad paid for itself, and the special phone number hooked up to the ad proved it. Moving to Yelp, on the other hand, is time-consuming and feels risky. No control, no proven history. For smaller businesses, the move from expensive, slow, and difficult-to-measure brand ads to quick, agile, and measurable direct ads is a positive shift. But it's not easy to act like a direct marketer when you're trying to reach people who generally don't click on ads. A simple guide to online direct marketing. The ad exists to get a click. The click exists to either make a sale or earn permission. The sale exists to lead to another sale or to word of mouth. Permission exists to lead to education and to a sale. That's it. Every step in the process has a cost. You paid cash at the first step, but along the way, you will lose some of those people who drop out. And every step also leads you closer to the benefit. Assign values to each step. If you can't, don't run any direct response ads until you can. Will some people see your ads without taking action? Definitely. That's a side effect, a culture-shifting, awareness-building bonus. But if you can't measure it, it doesn't count. A simple guide to brand marketing. Everything you do, from the way you answer the phone to the design of your packaging, from your location to the downstream effects of your work, from the hold music to the behavior of your executives, and even the kind of packing peanuts you use, all of it is a form of marketing your brand. You can't measure it. You might not even notice it. But it still matters. You're already spending money on brand marketing, no doubt about it. The question is, what would happen if you spent a bit more? What if you spent it with intention? If you could patiently invest more time and money in putting the story of your brand in the world, how would you do it? You could certainly buy full-page ads in the local paper or put a commercial on network TV. There's a long tradition of this sort of spending. You can make a big statement in very little time. It's fun. It doesn't require buy-in from anyone except your boss or someone else with a budget. It's one and done, and you can move on to tomorrow. It might be the best way to spend your money. Sponsoring a tennis tournament or a podcast might work wonders as well. Maybe. Or perhaps you should overinvest in the way your team interacts with customers. Or perhaps you should spend a few million dollars on research and development, or go back to school to improve your craft. The most important lesson I can share about brand marketing is this. You definitely, certainly, and surely don't have enough time and money to build a brand for everyone. You can't. Don't try. Be specific. Be very specific. And then, with this knowledge, overdo your brand marketing. Every slice of every interaction ought to reflect the whole. Every time we see any of you, we ought to be able to make a smart guess about all of you. Frequency. People don't remember what they read, what they hear, or even what they see. If they're lucky, people remember what they do, but they're not very good at that either. We remember what we rehearse. We remember the things that we see again and again, that we do over and over. We remember our Uncle Fred, who came to Christmas 20 years in a row, but we don't remember his date Ethel, who came just that one time. There are obvious evolutionary reasons we're optimized for this. We have to prune memories relentlessly, and the easiest memories to prune are the ones that are random noise. We remember the events we have photos for in our family scrapbook, but we don't remember the events that weren't photographed. It has nothing to do with the act of taking a picture, and everything to do with rehearsing our story, the one we tell every time we see that picture. Along the way, this has pushed us to associate trust with the events and stories that happen again and again. The familiar is normal, and the normal is trusted. Marketers forget this daily because we get bored with our stuff, our story, our change. We've heard it before. We remember it, but we're bored, and so we change it. Jay Levinson famously said, "Don't change your ads when you're tired of them. Don't change them when your employees are tired of them. Don't even change them when your friends are tired of them. Change them when your accountant is tired of them." We can expand this well beyond ads. All the storytelling you do requires frequency. You'll try something new, issue a statement, explore a new market. And when it doesn't work right away, the instinct is to walk away and try something else. But frequency teaches us that there's a very real dip, a gap between when we get bored and when people get the message. Lots of people start a project. They give a talk a few times, maybe even on the TED stage, and then they go off to do the next thing. They launch a new freelance business, get a few clients, then it sputters, and they quit. Or they open a company, raise money, and spend it fast, hitting the wall just before the good stuff happens. The market has been trained to associate frequency with trust. There, I just said it again. If you quit right in the middle of building that frequency, it's no wonder you never got a chance to earn the trust. Search engine optimization and the salt mines. The Google ecosystem is based on a myth. The myth is that millions and millions of businesses, all grooming themselves for the search engine, will be found by people who seek them. Dating sites offer the same promise, as do the social networks. Simply fit in all the way, follow all the rules, and when we search for tire store or restaurant or freelance copy editor or even fun weekend date, we will find you. The math can't support this. There are 1,000 pages of results. What delusion we must be under to imagine we will be the first match. The path isn't